On its own, Parmenides provides the contemporary scholar with a myriad of intractable difficulties. For example, the method Plato outlines in the dialogue, and then the subsequent example he gives in its second half, the relation of this method to other mentions and discussions of hypotheses and hypothetical method in the Meno, Phaedo, and Republic, and the other dialectical methods of division and collection in the Phaedrus and Sophist, for example. To understand Proclus's own interpretation of the Parmenidean method provides another set of complications. The influence of Stoic logic, which is mediated by the Aristotelian Alexander, the development of Stoic logic towards some form of biconditionality, a dominant tendency to synthesize Plato's diverse corpus into one coherent, positive Neoplatonic view, the relation of Plato and Aristotle, along with the development of how that relation is considered within the history of Neoplatonism. To present how Proclus understood the Parmenidean method, which is a part of today's goal, I would have to account for all of these, but I must leave them behind. One particularly important, if but problematic, aspect of Proclus's interpretation of the method, which I must also leave behind, is his assertion that the methods of the Aristotelian definition, demonstration, analysis, and synthesis are the same as what we find in the Parmenides. Referring to the Aristotelian commentator's account of these methods, A.C. Lloyd calls them a congenital blemish of imperial commentaries. I would wager Proclus's attempts to prove his assertion to fall somewhere between non-existent and a dog's breakfast. For today, I would like to focus on one Aristotelian text to which Proclus refers, and which would help us understand how he interprets the Parmenidean method. At one point, while interpreting the Parmenidean method, Proclus says, with a straight face, that Aristotle had imitated this method. Victor Cousin, in his edition, points us rightly towards Prior Analytics, Book 1, Chapter 27. And so my goal today is twofold, to look at Prior Analytics 127, and how Alexander, and to a lesser extent Philoponus, interpreted it, to help us understand how Proclus understood it and the method of the Parmenides, and to a lesser extent to evaluate Proclus as a witness of late ancient interpreters. One further clarification about my aim today. With the exception of one or two instances, scholars of Proclus have focused on the example of the hypothetical method in the second half, the negative theology of the first one and the first hypothesis, the nature of nous in the second, and so on. I will not be focusing on that, but rather on how Proclus interprets the small passage of the Parmenides where Plato, through Parmenides, describes the method. I think this is worthy in its own right to understand how Proclus understood the method and how the late ancients interpreted the analytics, at least this part of the analytics. I also think that, once accomplished, we will better be able to understand what Proclus is doing in the interpretation of the second half, to introduce some logical rigor into the heart of what Hegel called the philosophical freak of Neoplatonism. But this latter adventure must wait for a later day. My proposal today is this. My kind of the overarching thing that I've learned thinking about this again. Alexander's understanding of Aristotle, Aristotle's entire project, allows diverse parts of the Aristotelian corpus to be presented in a digestible and a suggestive manner, something that's well known. Thus, what happens in Prior Analytics 127 does not stay in Prior Analytics 127, but rather it is Alexander's facility in seeing connections between various parts of Aristotle and his uncanny ability to break problems down for the purpose of clarity. And it is herein that lies Alexander's real value to Proclus. As one of the goals of my talk is to understand how Proclus understood the method of the Parmenides, we should outline what Plato himself said. And so you can look at the first text there. Parmenides advises the young Socrates to consider the consequences of the hypothesis, not only if each thing in question is hypothesized to exist, but also if the same thing is hypothesized not to exist. At this point, Socrates does not understand what Parmenides means, and so Parmenides gives him an example of his proposed method based on Zeno's hypothesis, if the many are. You should consider what must follow, both for the many things in relation to themselves and in relation to the one, and also for the one in relation to itself and in relation to the many. Then, on the other hand, if there are not many things, consider again what follows for the one and for the many, both in relation to themselves and in relation to each other. And, in a word, whatever you suppose that anything whatsoever exists and does not exist and has any other attribute, you ought to consider the consequences with reference to itself and to each one of the other things that you may select, and several of them, and all of them together. And again, you must understand these others with reference both to themselves and to any one thing you may select, whether you have assumed the things to exist or not to exist, if you are really going to win through to a sight of the truth after a complete course of training. The text is familiar enough, and traditionally, how this method has been understood has, in general, rendered the method itself, has, in general, rendered 8 hypotheses. And we can look at the next selection of the text. So, for example, if the one is itself in relation to itself, what follows from that? Second hypothesis, if the one is itself in relation to the others, what follows from that? Third, if the one is others in relation to others, and then others in relation to the original hypothesis, what follows from that? And then the fifth to the eighth hypotheses would be if the one is not in that exact same form. What I would like to point out are some things that Proclus develops in original ways and which are essential to how Proclus interprets the method. First, Proclus follows Plato in seeing the method being able to investigate the implications not only if something exists or not, but also if it has any other attribute. So, for example, not only if the one is, but also, as we'll see later, if soul is immortal, what follows from that? No ancient commentators, and I can't remember a single contemporary scholar who actually cottons on to this part of Plato's text. Second, he takes the vague term of sumbanine and its derivatives and understands in the Platonic text, and understands Plato to understand this in a threefold manner: what follows, what does not follow, and what both does and does not follow. And finally, Plato describes the dialectic that Socrates must undergo to be a gymnasia, training of some kind. And I highlight these things because I will develop them later. With this in mind, I will do a quick run-through of how Proclus interprets the Parmenidean method, and then turn to Aristotle, and then to Alexander, some Philoponus, and then back to Proclus. The first thing I would like to address is perhaps Proclus's most obvious, striking development of the hypothetical method. Here Proclus interprets the method in a way which renders 24 hypotheses, and I believe Proclus is the only person who actually interprets it this way in the history of the world, except for Amakartos, I believe. Proclus refers to. The key here lies in interpreting what follows from in a threefold way. He uses three different verbs to indicate this kind of consequence. And for now, I just want to note the tripartition and not yet interpret its significance. On the one hand, he uses hepatai, so this is Proclus, uses the verb hepatai and sumbanai on one hand, and on the other, and in other places and context, he uses estai. So if we look at the next passage in the handout, Plato's Method and Outline According to Proclus, we won't go through all of these, but just to give you a taste, if something is itself in relationship to itself, it follows that ABC. And so my point here is just that he uses three different verbs to indicate that. Of course, only sumbanai we would actually find in the Platonic text. If something is itself in a relationship to itself, it does not follow, right? And I should have indicated ukhepetai, ukhsumbanai, and ukhestai. If something is itself in a relationship to itself, it both does and does not follow. So on and so forth. All the way up to 24 hypotheses. Thus, by examining this concept of following of each of the eight hypotheses in three ways, one gets 24 improbable hypotheses. Of course, the outline itself of the method, which Plato gives, cannot justify this development. But Proclus, rather, looks towards the long example in the second half, where, indeed, we do find exactly this development. In the first hypothesis, we find a litany of attributes which do not follow. In the second, we see that these same things do follow. And in the third hypothesis, or the appendix to the second, we see that things both follow and do not follow. So while Proclus might seem liberal in his interpretation of this particular passage, he reasonably enough looks to Plato's help, to Plato's examples, for help in interpreting its apparent most synoptic form. We also noted above that Proclus closely reads the Platonic text and understands that the method operates in two different ways here, and we will try to explain the significance of Proclus's different usage of hepatai, sumbanai on one hand, and estai on the other. The first way the method can be used, which is what we are more familiar with, is the examination of the implications of the existence or non-existence of a thing. So, if the one is, it is not many, not a whole, not a part, so on and so forth. And as I noted above, the second way is not a common way of interpreting the method. And so Proclus comments on the method passage, the first passage on your handout. He's commenting on this passage in Plato, and I will quote the fourth text. Proclus is two ways of how the method works. There are two ways in which we undertake the examination of things. Sometimes we consider whether each thing exists or does not exist. That's the first. And sometimes whether this thing, the todeti, belongs or does not belong to it, as for instance, whether the soul is immortal. On this occasion, we are inquiring not only as to the existence or otherwise of all the attributes, tasambuananta, of the thing hypothesized, itself with respect to itself and to others, and for others with respect to themselves and to it, but also as to its belonging or not belonging. Proclus then goes on to give an example of this other way of looking at the method, using the example of if soul is immortal, something that will be important for us later in Philoponus. Proclus, in his commentary, gives 8 extra examples or outlines of how the method actually works. However, only one is actually an example of the second usage, and I believe he includes this only to provide a rigorous interpretation of the given Platonic lemma. Plainly, he is intending 2 very different purposes to the method. We have another curious problem. When he uses the first method, he mostly uses the verb hepatai, sometime sumbesitai, to indicate the kind of following from the antecedent. However, only when he uses the second method, he explains it once and he uses it once, does he use the verb at the form estai. In the examples of the first kind, as we find in the commentary, there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of the verb hepatai, 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 ukhepatai, but none are to be found in the text of Plato's Parmenides. So what's the difference here? While Plato and Proclus suggest the first usage of the method would be to merely investigate the existence of a given thing, there's obviously more going on. It's not just about if the one exists. It's about, given the fact that the one exists, what else belongs to it, what else exists along with it. For Proclus, it allows for an examination of that term or being in every aspect or mode possible. It would, I would suggest, give you a tremendous amount of information about that being and its relation to itself and anything other than it, which we will talk about more below. The second use of the method, which would appear to achieve something much simpler and operates close to a biconditional propositional logic. We suppose a certain proposition, in this case, for example, whether immortality belongs to soul, and we see what follows from that. If the consequence reveals something true, you would have sufficient conditions necessary for its truth. But if you add on the negative hypotheses, you reveal something absurd. Both hypotheses provide sufficient and necessary conditions for that the proposition is true. While in the first usage of the method, we can perform a comprehensive examination of all the attributes of the subject hypothesized, yielding much information about a given term or being, the second merely demonstrates the predication of one term to the other without specifying how they're predicated of each other or what their specific relationship is. I also believe that the first usage of the method involves biconditionality, but that is another huge topic, including the role of Stoic logic in, via Alexander. But my point now today is that an hypothesis such as if soul is immortal has a much more limited role, while Proclus's seemingly preferred usage of the method displays incredible virtuosity. For the purposes of this paper, I'm going to focus on this first use of the method, as I believe this is closer to what Aristotle has imitated, according to Proclus. Now that we have a general outline of how Proclus interprets the method, we are better able to understand his observation that Aristotle imitated the method which Plato outlines in the Parmenides. And here we have the next text, Proclus on Aristotle's imitation. I know certainly that Aristotle, in his imitation of this method, the Parmenides, aims in the case of his categorical syllogisms to set out the predicates and the subjects and what does not belong to the subjects and the predicate, stating what follows and what does not follow from it, and what it is posterior to. What is set out here in the Parmenides, however, is far more complete. Having assumed every mode through division, through which one must proceed for the exercising of one's intellect on each aspect of being, arousing the investigative faculty of the soul through all the aforementioned hypotheses, and perfecting the capacity to discover the truth about each thing. When we are in pursuit of reality, to pragmata, we are more likely to discover it through this system than through that of Aristotle. Since through this multiplicity of hypotheses, all 24 of them, we can track down with more finesse the subject of investigation. As noted above, Cousin points us to Pyranalytics 127, which Philoponus and others tell us begins the second part of the prior analytics. Aristotle, in the first section of the prior analytics, outlined the structure of all the valid syllogisms, how they come about, the definition of the terms. But with prior analytics 127, he looks at where and how he will get the material, all the terms, to produce the syllogisms. Aristotle then proceeds to limit the search for the appropriate terms or beings, as he says in this procedure, and I will constantly refer to them as terms or beings. I think had Aristotle simply used the word terms, I don't think this would have stopped Proclus from interpreting them as beings. But at least in this one particular instance, Aristotle was helpfully Neoplatonic in his interpretation of the categorical logic. Aristotle outlines three kinds of entities, only one of which we should presently employ strictly, and we'll talk about that. The first kind of beings are such that they cannot be predicated of anything else truly and universally, but other things may be predicated of them. By this, Aristotle refers to individuals, such as Callias. Things may be predicated of them, but only accidentally, for example, whiteness, baldness, and so on. The second are themselves predicated of others, but nothing prior is predicated of them. With these, Aristotle says, there is an upward limit to the process of predicating. Of these, it is not possible to demonstrate another predicate, save as a matter of opinion, but these may be predicated of other things. And I'm trying to emphasize that there's wiggle room in Aristotle's text, which Alexander will open it, a wide door for Proclus. So these last group of beings he refers to are the categories. And finally, the third kind of being are those which are predicated of others, and yet others are predicated of them. These last things are the things which will comprise the material for syllogisms, and are therefore the object of Aristotle's consideration in this chapter. The technical or the formal reason for the selection of this kind of term is that, as Ross points out, the highest and lowest terms cannot serve as middle terms in a first figure syllogism, since there the middle term is subject of one premise and the predicate of the other. But the highest terms can actually serve as major terms, and the lowest terms as minor terms. That is, the validity of all syllogisms occur through first figure syllogisms, and the first figure syllogism's validity occurs through the middle term in such a syllogism. The middle term in this figure is the reason, literally, the that through which the conclusion is valid. To have a category or an individual particular as a middle term in the first figure would be to provide as a reason something that is accidental or cannot be proven except by opinion, exceptions to which we will have recourse soon. So now to the text where Aristotle describes this separate method and which Proclus thinks that Aristotle copied from Plato. And this is also on your handout. Aristotle on finding the terms for syllogisms. We must select the premises suitable to each problem in this manner. First, we must hypothesize the subject and the definitions and whatever is the property of the subject. Sorry about the Greek. Next, after this, I'm sure you guys can actually read this after long enough fudging about with the keyboard, the Roman keyboard. It's a new language. And again, those which the thing follows, and then whatever cannot belong to it. Of the terms which follow, we must distinguish those which fall within the essence, and those which are predicated as properties, and those which are predicated as accidents, and of the latter, those which are apparently and those which really do belong. The larger the supply a man has of these, the more quickly he will reach a conclusion, and in proportion as he apprehends those which are truer, the more cogently will he demonstrate. Aristotle's point here is that to employ his three-term syllogism, one needs to provide a definition of that thing and to situate the given subject or term, or being, within its class, both in terms of what is above it and what is below it. As well, one must provide other terms that are related to it, and also understand how those other terms are related to it, and how those things maybe are not related to it. That is to say, to construct a valid syllogism, one must order the terms or the beings of the conclusion of the syllogism in an ordered manner, observing precisely how each term is related to each. The actual employment of the Aristotelian categorical syllogisms themselves presuppose the selection and knowledge of at least three terms that are somehow related to each other and whose relation is in fact known or hypothesized, so that the appropriate form of syllogism, Barbara, Derupti, Philopton, and so on, can be identified and employed, or vice versa, created. So prior to the categorical syllogism itself, therefore, one must set out an array of terms and their relation to each other. And what I want to point out here is the term that Aristotle uses to connote this following, for the most part, is hepatai. I mean, if you look at chapter 27, chapter 28, there are 50 uses of it, right? So you can see that Proclus is getting his vocabulary from somewhere. On a side note, A.C. Lloyd's treatment of Proclus on precisely this topic in his Anatomy of Neoplatonism is just wrong, top to bottom. He thinks Proclus is comparing Platonic division with the categorical syllogism itself. He is aware, Lloyd is aware, but rejects the possibility that the prior activity to forming categorical syllogisms is what Proclus refers to here in the Analytics. So that's the Aristotelian method. And so now I want to to kind of fill this in, I want to look at how Alexander explains it. And it's probably the best explanation out there. This is not... what's interesting about Prior Analytics 127 is not many people have actually commented on it. Ross has helpful notes, but he doesn't really get into the nitty-gritty. And really, it's only, I guess this makes sense, Lukasiewicz and Patzig who kind of get into it. But aside from that, no one touches this. And it's interesting that Alexander's probably the best expositor of it, and probably followed closely by Philoponus. Anyways, here in this case, looking at Book 1, Chapter 28, where Aristotle gives explanations of it, of how the method works. Alexander's being a very sober, unexciting, good Aristotelian commentator, so I think we can trust him. So, how does this example work? I will rely on Alexander on Chapter 28. So, let us say we wanted to be able to construct a syllogism with a conclusion that involved the terms or the beings pleasure and good. In this case, we want to create a universal affirmative conclusion. All pleasure is good. And so when I'm discussing this, when I'm discussing Alexander's presentation of the method, keep in mind the Parmenides and just imagine Proclus reading Alexander's commentary. And so we can just look at the next section on the handout, Alexander on Prior Analytics 128. So what you do is you take a term or a being, good, right? That's the term for now that's under consideration. And you say, So first, what you do is you posit B, or the things within B that are consequence of A. Next, you posit C, and things within C that are antecedents of A. And you also posit... in fact, Aristotle uses the word hypothesize, right? Again, these words will be just triggering things in Proclus's mind. And so for D, you posit a set of terms which would not hold to the term good. So, for example, we sit down and we say, well, what are the consequences of the good above it? For instance, you could find the term beneficial. Good is beneficial. Choice-worthy. Worthy of pursuit. Appropriate. Profitable. Advantageous. Desirable. These are all good things. Okay. Now, what about antecedents of the good, which we would find below it? We would find happiness, completeness. We would find the virtues, activity in accordance with virtue, bodily goods, external goods, natural things. And, for example, not belonging to it in the set of D, we would find harmful, bad, disadvantageous, unprofitable, ugly, incomplete. And you would repeat the same again with pleasure. You can see that the schema there. So for the consequence, the consequences of pleasure, you would find unimpeded activity of a natural condition, something undisturbed, calm, pleasing, easy, painless, unfrightening, natural, choice-worthy. And for the antecedents, health, good fortune, blessed with children, activity in accordance with virtue, and abundance. And what would not belong to it, sickness, labor, pain, fear, want. So now we have the array of terms with a reasonable idea of how they are related to the original term, each of the original terms. He then says that for a universal affirmative, we should take something from C, the antecedents of the good, and something from E, the consequence of pleasure, which are the same, or as Alexander puts it, thought to be the same as each other. And he comes up with the following awkward syllogism. This is Alexander. All pleasure is unimpeded activity of a natural condition or completeness in natural activity, if this is a definition of pleasure and a consequent of it. Completeness in natural activity, since it is complete, is good. Therefore, all pleasure is good. It's not the prettiest example, but one does get an idea of what Aristotle wanted and what Proclus himself might have seen with Alexander's help. So now I want to shift away from Alexander being a very sober commentator sticking to the text and just looking for those moments in his interpretation of this chapter where he opens a door for Proclus. And I think they're quite evident, actually, and helpful. Earlier, when discussing those things which are in the defining account of a thing, Alexander makes an observation about the relation between terms. And this would be the next passage. Alexander on denying the existence of one term. For the things contained in the defining account of something are predicated in its essence in the strict sense. And if a thing of which they are predicated were deprived of their actuality, it would absolutely not exist at all. For example, if a human being were not animal, it would not exist. And similarly, it would not exist if it were not rational, or if it were not mortal, seeing that every human being is going to die. And in fact, we can see something similar in Porphyry. So I think I've found something here. Speaking of what the genus and differentia have in common, he states that, the next passage, they also have in common that if either the genus or the differentia, were removed, what is under it, that is, the species, would be removed. So just as if animal did not exist, neither would horse nor would man. So also, if rationality did not exist, neither would the life using reason. And this is just something I want to point out, and which is kind of part of my thing that I've learned writing this paper. Here you see that Alexander is not actually explaining how the method works, but rather he's explaining the relationship of terms, upon which relation one can construct the hierarchy of terms or beings. He's not actually explaining the line-for-line Aristotelian text, but, you know, what makes the method work? Well, there's a certain relationship between terms. And if you take one term away, the other one will disappear, right? So he's making more of an aside from Aristotle's text than actually, Proclus is reading this. And it doesn't really matter where it comes from, right? But it's within the context of Alexander making comments on chapter 27, chapter 28, that Aristotle, that Proclus, rather, you start to see that this accusation by Proclus is actually not far out once certain doors are opened, and it's Alexander who is holding the door open. We see that Aristotle says that the highest beings, the highest genera or categories, are predicable of others truly, but others are not predicated of them. However, as I noted, he adds a caveat that one might make these predications as a matter of opinion. Alexander, and here's where Alexander, he's just being a very thorough commentator, and he does pick his preferred interpretation, but he's, again, just saying these are very probable ways of interpreting Aristotle's text. So he interprets this clarification of predicating as a matter of opinion in three possible ways. The first is, Aristotle's problem with such predications is that one could assent to something falsely and then draw false conclusions from that. Right? So this is why we don't want to look for these kinds of beings in 127. Second, one may make accidental predications for the purpose of clarification, which is important for us, but we'll skip that for now. And finally, Alexander suggests a connection between Aristotle's use of the word opinion here and the endoxa of the topics and its dialectical method. And of course, this is what I think Proclus is jumping on, the final one. In fact, the concern for the apparent similarity or the apparent connection between the Aristotelian dialectic and its use of opinion dominates Proclus's interpretation of the Parmenides' dialectic. As we saw above, Parmenides adjures Socrates to train himself in dialectic. And the example given in the second half of the dialogue, with arguing for something and with arguing against something, could be seen to be an Aristotelian dialectic. In the opening of the topics, Aristotle says that one of the uses of his dialectic is to train. And one of the main ways of testing a problem is to investigate both sides of it, if it is and if it isn't. In Proclus, there is a deeply thought-out reflection on the relation of the Aristotelian-based dialectic, and it's different from Plato's dialectic, or his interpretation of Plato's dialectic. But this is to say that he had to argue for their difference because he and others also saw many similarities. And it's again, kind of Alexander is the person who, you can go two ways with this, right? You can just ignore this passage of Aristotle, you could ignore this passage of Alexander, and kind of like Plotinus, just keep marching on. But in this case, Proclus grabs the bull by the horns and says, absolutely right. Gymnastics training is one of the purposes of dialectic. And you know what? We can actually find it in one part of the Parmenides. So instead of, say, so any time that Aristotle in the Prior Analytics says, you can't predicate the highest genera, right? But maybe by opinion. For Proclus, this says, well, as an Aristotelian, you would say that. But as a Platonist, we don't use opinion ever anyways. Right, so all of these throwaway words, Alexander, not throwaway words, but things that an average Aristotelian would read and say, well, okay, that makes sense. And they would continue reading. Alexander, he sits down and he looks at the whole corpus and he says, well, gosh, what actually could this mean? This could mean a few things. And even though Alexander might, his final decision might be something more orthodox Aristotelian, for Proclus, he says, thank you very much, Alexander. I'll take that explanation and I'll run with it in a way that you would never ever want, that you would never intend. So I'll continue. So Alexander makes another important observation about the status of individuals in the highest genera. And this I did not put on the handout. Ran out of space. So again, Alexander is in the middle of he's trying to figure out why Aristotle would or would not include these extreme terms in his investigation. And this is, I think, his fifth try. Or perhaps, maybe we can prove that the highest genus holds of a thing in terms of the thing proposed if we take the antecedent of that genus. For antecedents are useful for proving predication of all, as Aristotle will show later. But you know, a highest genus has its antecedents, things below it. Then he goes on to say that an individuals, in turn, have consequence. Alexander continues, for we will not take both the consequence and antecedents in the case of all terms, but only when there are antecedents and consequence. Right? So for the categories, you can actually take an antecedent. And for an individual, you can find a consequent. So his point, Alexander's point here, seems to be one is able, in a limited way, to use this method in relation to the highest genera, right? For a Platonist, this is gravy, right? And also, you can use them for individuals, but this is of less concern for Proclus. Of course, one would not be able to see what is consequent above it, above the highest genera, but one would be able to learn something about it based on its antecedents, what are below it. What I want to point out here is that Alexander points towards, in a few ways in fact, that some sort of meaningful discourse about the highest genera, which opening Proclus will use, in particular in his interpretation of the so-called negative theology of the first hypothesis. I think this is an important source. I think it is important that an important source of Proclus's interpretation of that hypothesis comes from Alexander's somewhat reasonable expansion of Aristotle's method. And I wanted to talk more about Philoponus, and I only want to kind of raise one very small thing. I ran out of time, and to be honest with you, at least with regard to chapter 27, I think we can classify Philoponus's commentary, again, to be quite sober. There's no need for a Christian polemics. There's no Platonic polemics. In this sense, I mean, I think it's possible he had I think it's possible he had Alexander's commentary in front of him. And in a sense, I was kind of disappointed that there wasn't anything kind of sexy that wasn't also there in Alexander. My hope was, before looking at Philoponus, was that we would get some wonderful clues about how Proclus interpreted the Parmenidean method. Because Ammonius audited Proclus's lectures on the Prior Analytics, and he wrote an Apophanes commentary. Kind of, he took his notes and took the professor's notes and filled them in. The lectures stop at chapter 26, which was also disappointing. However, Philoponus was a student of Ammonius, and these are apparently Philoponus's commentary on Prior Analytics were based on Philoponus's own lecture notes from Ammonius's classes. So I was kind of hoping that we could find something really juicy that indicated something of Proclus's mind in this regard. But unfortunately, Philoponus was a pretty sober commentator at this particular moment, and there really is kind of nothing that I could tell. The one thing I do want to, and again this kind of jumped out at me, when Philoponus tries to show what this method is, how it works, he says, I'll give you an example. He says, why don't we take the example if soul is immortal? And I just thought, oh yes, right? This is the example that Proclus used, this is the example that Alexander used. And nothing happens with it. And this is why I went in to talk about the propositional logic of this. For Proclus, right, if soul is immortal, right, that is an atomic proposition in the antecedent of a conditional sentence, right? He doesn't actually, it's if P, right? He doesn't take it apart and look at the terms. Whereas for Philoponus, he actually sits down and he says, okay, let's hypothesize if soul is immortal. Well, how does that work? Well, first, let's take a look at soul. Then let's look at immortality. And he does exactly what Aristotle says we should do. And he follows pretty much what Alexander does. So that was a little disappointing. I thought that I'd found something. But then you keep reading and you're kind of disappointed. I wanted to include more Philoponus on this, but I don't think there's much more to include, which we haven't already seen in Alexander, which leads me to conclude that Philoponus probably also had Alexander's commentary. So I want to turn back to Proclus right now. So we have the Plato, we have the Aristotle, we have Alexander on Aristotle. So we've got all the pieces. Now let's try and understand this method. So.
Yeah, cool. I mean, but you can go on 5 more minutes and
okay.
Leave it for into the discussion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Five more minutes.
Approximately.
Yeah. Okay. So the question is, you know, does Proclus's reference back to Aristotle and his imitating, does this help us understand how Proclus understands the Parmenidean method? And my short answer is to a very great extent. And where it doesn't help, for the most part, Proclus doesn't help either. And I think to really give a solid and rigorous interpretation of Proclus, how Proclus understands the method, it's based on a lot of stitching together and surmise. But I do think that what Alexander and what between Alexander and Alexander Philoponus and Aristotle, we can understand the method a little bit better. Now, if you take, say, the first, so if you look at the 24 hypotheses on the previous page, the third selection there, Plato's method in outline according to Proclus. So if you look at the first three, so the first three hypotheses are all itself in relationship to itself. And I think this is, I think we can nail it. I think we can make very secure guesses about how Proclus actually understood these. And the first is that this form of itself in itself following indicates essential predication. The next one, number two, if something is itself in relation to itself, it does not follow. Well, this just means it simply does not belong. And I think, for instance, if you've sat down and read The Sophist enough times, this is a perfectly orthodox Platonic thing to say, and it has its uses. And then number three, if something is itself in relationship to itself, it both does and does not follow. Well, this is accidental predication, right? That and these, the first two, well, in each of these, rather, you can actually find in how Alexander, well, you can find it actually in a simplified version in Aristotle's text, right? So you can suddenly see, and of course, if you don't have the following, not following, both following and not following, which is not in the original outline of the Platonic text, you can't actually square the Platonic text with Aristotle. But because Proclus, I think, is so heavily influenced by Alexander and thereby through Aristotle, he looks at, brilliantly, I think, he looks at the second half of the Parmenides, looks at the first hypothesis, the second hypothesis, the third slash appendix, third hypothesis slash appendix, and he says, oh my gosh, this is, he reads the Parmenidean hypotheses in the second half of the Parmenides using Aristotelian logic. I mean, nobody has seen this. Well, even no one before Proclus nor after Proclus has actually seen this. Fine. I think we're on safe ground. Once we turn to numbers, the hypotheses 4 to 6, I'm still comfortable, but I think it's less certain. And in 4 to 6, we're looking at itself in relationship to others. And for me, this is an examination of causality. And the itself and the others can, the itself can be the cause and the others can be the effect, or the itself can be the effect and the others can be the cause, right? There's no, there's nothing in the Platonic system that that tells you have to order what the reference of these terms are. And of course, you can see how for Proclus, sort of for a Neoplatonist, but especially for a Neoplatonist like Proclus, where you want, it is not enough to say nous is the cause of everything and kind of say, well, there's this unfolding. Again, Proclus uses a very weird part of Aristotle to specify, to make specific the relationship of a cause to an effect. And if we look at 4, right, if X something is itself in relationship to others, let's just say the itself is a higher term and the others is a lower term, so cause-effect, it follows that JKL. I think here we can see per se causality. With number 5, no causality, which again, an Aristotelian might laugh at this, but for a Platonist, that's just fine. And for number 6, itself in relation to others, it both follows and doesn't follow. Again, it's that cause, the posited cause, is not a per se cause. It's a co-cause, right? So you are determining both what the cause is in relationship to a given term and what that term's relationship is to that given cause. And I think the other for the hypotheses 10 to 12, I think the same thing holds. You just do it in the opposite order. And I would be interested in your feedback here. I can't fully understand yet the purpose of hypotheses 7, 8, and 9, right? If the one is, for example, let's consider the others in relationship to themselves, right? It follows that this, it doesn't follow, it both does and does not follow. I mean, I guess you could, you try, the point of this is to try and understand what these other things are if in separation from the given hypothesis. Again, I still don't fully understand that, nor would I mean, I think these are actually the trickiest hypotheses, because, for example, what would it mean that, what would the kind of following, what would that actually mean? What would be per se causality of the others on their own? What would be their accident, what would be their relationship to something else accidentally in separation, not considering the subject of the hypothesis? Unfortunately, Proclus himself doesn't actually help us in this regard. But this is all to say that I think using Aristotle, Prior Analytics, Book 1, Chapter 7, Chapter 28 also, I think it does help us. But, you know, for instance, when I first sat down and read this a long time ago, I mean, I really thought that this accusation was laughable. Because I sat down and read Aristotle's text, and I thought, well, this is, come on, Proclus. But then I sat down and read Alexander's commentaries, not just only on the analytics, but also in the topics. And not just say Proclus on this method, but also Proclus on dialectic. As I said earlier, Proclus, he's got thanks for coming. He's got big game here. He's got a very global view of the problems and how they're connected. And I think Proclus gets all of these connections from Alexander. And I think if you sit down and read Alexander, when he talks about the method, I don't think he's actually that helpful. But if you look at everything around what he says about the method and explaining general, what is predicated of others but not what you can predicate of something but what is not predicated of something. Well, that's not prior analytics. That's not metaphysics. This is first year Aristotle. But for Alexander, he makes all of these connections at the crucial moments. And I think these are the things that allow Proclus to interpret Aristotle in a certain way and to see connections with Proclus's Parmenides, and which I think help us understand how, this is the operating system of Proclus and how Proclus wants to understand the world minutely and specifically and in a profoundly scientific manner.